This is Melissa Harris Perry, and on today's episode of The Takeaway, we're looking at issues of race through the lens of documentary media. Now, like us here at The Takeaway, we know many of you have been following efforts by many state legislators to ban the teaching of critical race theory in public schools. And yesterday here on the show, we spoke with Janae Nelson. She's the incoming president of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. During our conversation, she emphasized that the fight for a fair and equitable nation rests on the ability of communities to openly and honestly examine the history of their collective experiences.
We are in the midst of a serious battle, a fight for the soul of this country. It centers around our ability to hear, access, and absorb the truth.
So today, we're going to talk about a documentary film, an investigative podcast, and a Hollywood movie. And each tells us a true American story. And each is centered on racialized experiences in our country. So let's start by going back to 1971.
There was 70% black and brown prisoners, all white guards. What could go wrong?
Grab the guards, grab the keys.
All hell broke loose.
Attica. The name is now synonymous with what happened there 50 years ago. Overcrowding in the upstate New York Supermax prison was appalling, and conditions were harsh, many even describing them as inhumane.
Guys were complaining about the basic things like toothpaste. A roll of toilet paper lasts you a month.
The inmates were considered like animals.
They beat you up in your cell, and then they take you to segregation, and sometimes you don't come back.
You're hearing footage from the documentary Attica by filmmakers Stanley Nelson and Tracy Curry. Using archival footage and original interviews, the movie explores the deadliest prison rebellion in American history, which occurred over the course of 5 days in 1971, when Attica's population of overwhelmingly Black and Latino inmates seized control of a portion of the prison, taking 39 guards and staff as hostages. For 4 days, these men inside Attica sought the recognition of elected officials about the appalling conditions they were forced to endure inside the prison. And the demands these men made, they actually resonate today. Take, for example, that advocates have described the current conditions at Rikers Island as a humanitarian crisis. In fact, more than a dozen pre-trial detainees, in other words, people who have not yet even been convicted of a crime, have died in custody at Rikers this year. And Rikers inmates have described sleeping on the floor and having to relieve themselves in bags because there aren't enough toilets. 50 years ago, conditions like these reached a breaking point in Attica. And with prisoners holding hostages, they commanded media attention. But ultimately, the relentless attention also fed the mounting tensions outside the embattled prison. And on the fifth day, New York's governor ordered a breach. Helicopters dropped tear gas. State troopers and the National Guard shot into the haze. They killed 29 inmates and 10 prison guards who were being held as hostages. Akil Shakur, one of the survivors of the assault that day, spoke to Joseph Jedion, a producer here on The Takeaway, and he spoke to him for the WNYC series, Storming the Gates, 50 years after the Attica prison uprising.
They shot the gas into the corridor where we was at in A Block corridor. It was so cloudy, it tore the skin off your arm. That gas was pepper gas. They wouldn't use it in Vietnam. They came in shooting, and it was only like 8 or 9 of us up in A Block corridor. So I told my friend, who I knew from the street for years, don't go out first and don't go out last. Let's get between. And what happened was, when we went out, when I looked around, I thought they were shooting rubber bullets. They shot the guy in the neck and blood came out. I felt something hit me in my chest.
Tyrone Larkins was also there.
Correction officers, state troopers, National Guards quelled a riot with shotguns, assault rifles, tear gas that literally knocked people to their knees. They showed that to the whole world. Picture a barrel, a big barrel, okay, with a whole bunch of fish in it, and a guy standing over the barrel with a shotgun and pulling the trigger. That's what happened, man.
Larkins is featured in the documentary Attica, and I spoke about the film with one of its co-directors, Stanley Nelson.
Attica was and is a maximum security prison, 250 miles upstate from New York City. In 1971, at September 9th of 1971, the prisoners took over Attica. It was the largest prison rebellion in the history of the United States. Because they took over 30 guards and civilian prison workers hostage, they had a standoff which lasted for 5 days while the prisoners demanded certain changes in the prison. One of the things that makes Attica so different from any other prison rebellion, besides the outcome, of course, but is that the prisoners said that they wanted the media to come in and film the whole thing as they negotiated, as the rebellion took place. They felt that the media and filming would give them some kind of protection against retaliation by law enforcement. It ended disastrously, and over 40 people were killed in the retaking of Attica. All of them were killed by law enforcement.
And when you talk about law enforcement and you talk about prison guards, there's no escaping race at the core of this film and at the core of this experience. As you all were interviewing and having conversations, I was so struck by how swiftly we were introduced to the family of one of the key guards. Can you talk to me a little bit about that choice?
Yeah, one of the things that we talked about and we worked on really a lot is where to begin the film, you know, because the prison, the rebellion took place because of certain conditions in the prison. But we didn't want to start just talking about the conditions because you don't care, you know, if you're not introduced to the characters. So we throw you right in the middle of the rebellion, you know, as we're showing the opening credit, Attica, you know, you're hearing sirens and you're dropped right into the rebellion. And we go back and we talk about one of the guards, Billy Quinn, who's injured really badly on the first day when the prisoners took the prison. He was beaten very badly and taken out of the prison to a hospital right away. But the fact that he's injured really badly ends up kind of being one of the pivotal points in the whole rebellion.
Was it difficult to secure because it's the daughter who we meet. I mean, I guess it must be within like 3 minutes or something. And you're right. You do get thrown right into this documentary. Was it difficult to secure that kind of conversation?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it was difficult. It took a certain amount of gaining of trust from the people in the Attica town, this kind of all-white town. It also took a lot of trust building with the former prisoners. And so the people from the town, I think, add an incredible dimension. They actually, you know, were incredible. They gave us, you know, photos and their home movies. And so you really see kind of what Attica town was like. It was, you know, really kind of an all-white town, where the jobs really were provided by the prison. You know, somebody says, you know, it was a prison town. And that was, you know, fathers and sons worked in Attica prison. And that was the livelihood of the town.
I reflected as I heard that on the idea of like coal mining towns or company towns, and the idea that prisons become the economic engine, right? And that Attica is part of reminding us of, you know, we say something like the prison industrial complex, but what that actually looks like for real human beings.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, as the townspeople say, you know, that, you know, most of the people on their block worked in a prison, you know, and when we say, you know, a prison town, I mean, you have to understand that they were prison guards, but they had no training at all. It wasn't like they were sent to, you know, school, like, you know, and had to learn how to be a guard. You know, one day, you know, you're looking for a job and you're signing papers, and the next day, you know, you're a prison guard, and they were not trained in any way, and some of them were extremely brutal with the prisoners, as one of the former prisoners says, it was fear. They ruled the prisoners by fear.
And yet, we know that in so many ways, this is not how the story was presented. A lot of the film uses this incredible, previously unseen archival footage, including phone calls between President Richard Nixon and Governor Nelson Rockefeller. I'm wondering how you got access to this, and talk to us a little bit about what this brought to the film.
You know, it's very clear that Richard Nixon is pulling the strings behind the scenes. And as said in the film, you know, Rockefeller wanted to be president. I mean, that was his goal. You know, he's one of the richest men in the world. He had everything. You know, he wanted to be president. And he was thought of as being kind of, you know, soft on crime, you know, kind of the left wing of the Republican Party. And so he wanted to show that he was tough on crime. So he was on the phone constantly to Nixon. And at the crux of the prison rebellion, you know, after 4 days of kind of stalemate, the prisoners just want him to come up there to Attica. You know, okay, don't come in. You know, if you're scared to come in, you're nervous, don't come in. Just come up and show your concern. Also, by coming up, he would see what the conditions were and the mood was outside the prison, because National Guard and law enforcement, highway patrolmen, townspeople had been standing outside the prison for 5 days and were getting madder and madder, and rumors were circulating that the prisoners were castrating people and it killed people, and none of that was true, but those were the rumors. And the prisoners felt that if Rockefeller came and saw the mood of these people, he would think twice about sending them in to take back the prison, because it was obvious that they were out for revenge and that they were in many ways bloodthirsty. But you know, Rockefeller was talking to Nixon on the phone, and Nixon, you know, urged him not to go. And so that the prison rebellion in this tiny little town, Attica, 250 miles from New York, reached all the way to the president of the United States.
So the narrative was that that it was inmates who killed hostages. Talk to us about the truth of what really happened.
Yeah, well, in the final day of the rebellion, the fifth day, it was very clear that law enforcement was going to come in and take the prison by force. One of the things that the prisoners did was they took the hostages and put them on the catwalk so that everybody could see, and put these homemade knives to their throats. And as the inmates say, you know, in the film, they did that just so that law enforcement would think twice about coming in. You know, they had no intention of hurting these guys. But maybe if you see these guys, you know, that some of them were the brothers and cousins of the law enforcement, you would think twice and not do the massive retaking of the prison. But that didn't stop law enforcement and Rockefeller, and they took the prison by force. And I think 10 guards were killed, 29 prisoners. And the first newscast that they came out that we have in the film said that the, you know, the guards' throats were slit by the retaking of the prison. The prisoners slit the guards' throat. It came out the next day that no throats were slit, that actually they were killed by law enforcement as they took the prison. And that, as one of the prisoners says so beautifully, that, you know, they were running towards the guys with the guns thinking, we're saved. And they were killed, you know, at that moment by law enforcement.
I was so struck by the level of organizational capacity, the idea that the prisoners immediately begin organizing their sections, thinking about the list of demands, right, going into the work of negotiations. And yet, kind of where we began on these questions of race also became a critical aspect of how this all ended. Can you say a few words about that, about how race was intervening as a kind of wedge here?
Yeah, I mean, I think that you know, what I call, you know, casual racism is part of, you know, the story, and it's overwhelming. You know, the racism of the guards, you know, the all white guards, the prisoners were divided up by race, you know, and that really changed when they took over, you know, the prison. All of a sudden, as they say, you know, they became one unit. They became prisoners. They wasn't white or black or brown. You know, they had to unite to try to get out of, you know, what they had started and to try to get out of it with their lives. But race, it was just casually from, again, you know, the guards to when they take over, and they're constantly called the N-word, you know, over and over again. As you see in the film, on incredible footage, as the guards take over the prison, they yell white power. Nixon and Rockefeller, you know, Nixon calls him after the prison is retaken, and you know, 40 some people are killed, and the first thing Nixon asks are, is it the blacks? You know, were any white people killed? So it's over and over again, you know, race is kind of the subtext of the whole rebellion and the whole film.
Stanley Nelson, documentarian, filmmaker, director of Attica. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
We're going to put down the movie camera now and pick up our favorite storytelling device, the microphone, as we delve into a new investigative serial podcast from Reveal.
Hi, I'm Al Letson. I'm the host of Reveal, and we've been working on a serial called Mississippi Goddamn, The Ballad of Billy Joe.
Mississippi Goddamn takes its listeners to Loosedale, Mississippi. Located in the southeast corner of the state near Mobile, Alabama, Loosedale is a small town of about 3,000 residents, and more than a quarter of the population lives in poverty. This is where a black high school football star, Billy Joe Johnson, died during a traffic stop with a white deputy back in 2008. Now, the series is not your typical true crime podcast. It's an exploration of history, Southern identity, policing, and race. It's a story about Billy Joe, about Mississippi, but also about the investigators themselves. Al Letson is not a disinterested narrator. He's part of the story, engaging his own experiences, assumptions, and traumas, even as he seeks to uncover the truth of what happened.
But this is America. And the issues of policing and justice always come back. It's a predictable cycle. A black person is brutalized or killed by a police officer, racial tensions explode, and rarely is anyone held accountable.
Baltimore City leaders are urging patience this morning after another cop was acquitted in connection with the death of Freddie Gray.
Just like when I was a kid watching Rodney King.
Pittsburgh last night after a jury acquitted a white former police officer who shot and killed an unarmed black teen as he fled a traffic stop.
And the list keeps growing.
Philando Castile.
David McAtee.
Breonna Taylor.
Drayshawn Reed.
Tatiana Jefferson.
Michael Ramos.
Corin Gaines.
John Crawford.
Tamir Rice.
Alton Sterling.
Eric Garner.
When Al first went to Loosedale, Mississippi, he was reporting the Deepwater Horizon oil disaster. But he met Billy Joe's family and made a promise to them to look into Billy Joe's death. A decade later, he made good on that promise. And Al gave us a broad outline of the story and what happened to Billy Joe. Of course, without spoiling too much of what's in the series.
The story started in 2008, in December of 2008. We're actually coming up on the 13-year anniversary of it. And the story is Billy Joe Johnson was a 17-year-old black kid who was a really great athlete. He was loved in his community. You know, like really small towns in the South, high school football is a big thing, you know. And so he was the star and everybody kind of knew him. And he was dating a white girl on and off. At the time of his death, they weren't actually together. Early one morning, he gets pulled over by a police officer. And 5 minutes later, he's dead. And the police officer says that Billy took a shotgun out of his car and killed himself with it. And at the time, they said it was accidental. And then later, the story changed a little bit to it being a possible suicide. And I was reporting in 2011. I had really just gotten started in journalism at this point. And so I was reporting in 2011 on the Mississippi Gulf oil spill cleanup. And I went to Loosedale to talk to some of the people who were doing the cleanup, and they were mostly black folks. And they told me this story about Billy Joe and said that, you know, it hadn't really reached the national media. There'd been a couple little things, but nothing major. And they felt like their voices weren't being heard. And, you know, I'm from Jacksonville, Florida. I have a lot of family members that live in rural parts of the country. And when I was hanging out with them, I just felt like I was hanging with my people. And they asked me to look into it, and I did something I never do because people always ask me to look into stuff. But with this group of people, I promised them that I would look into it. It took a good little bit before I was able to actually work on it. And mostly, I think, because, well, two things. One is that, like, the story is really heavy, and I just wasn't sure I could do it justice for a while. And then two, going to Reveal, you know, Reveal has the investigative might to actually go out and do this type of story. So it took a little while, but we got the green light, and I started working on it about 3 years ago with my reporting partner, Jonathan Jones.
And the investigative aspect is right out there for us to hear. We can feel it and hear it as you walk through this process. And I so appreciate that part of how you introduce this is by saying, typically when there is a police involved shooting, if someone dies in police custody or even near or around police, what we get is an official report. And we always begin with reporting that official report. It's true for the media in general, right? We'll just say, well, police reports say, and police reports say is almost as though this is what happened. But instead, you actually walk us through, as you say in the podcast, the lived experience of Billy Joe Johnson. So talk to us a little bit about who Billy Joe was.
Yeah, I mean, like, Billy Joe, his future was bright. He comes from a pretty poor family in Mississippi. They loved him to death, obviously, and the community loved him a lot. He was a great football player. He had scholarships from, you know, all the top colleges, offers from all the top colleges. I mean, he was really getting ready to go somewhere. I think one of the stories that I think about a lot that actually didn't make it into the podcast because we just had so much material, but a couple of his friends told me that when they were like 16 years old, they had taken their older brother's IDs and had went to the big city, which was Mobile, Alabama, to go to a nightclub, you know. And so they went through all this stuff to get these IDs. They get into the nightclub. They go up to the bar, and all the other guys are ordering like a beer or whatever, and Billy Joe orders a Coke. And everybody looks at him like, we went through all of that for you to come here and get a Coke? And he was just like, yup. You know, so, I mean, that is like the type of kid that he was, you know. He stayed out of trouble. I think, you know, what you hear in the podcast is that there are allegations that he was abusive. The only people that backed up those allegations would be folks who are tied to the case a little bit. And not to say that those allegations aren't true, just that, like, I couldn't find anybody who really corroborated those. But he was, you know, a lot of people that I talked to said, like, you know, he was a big guy, but he was really gentle. Like, they literally, his nickname was Big Baby. So, yeah, he was a good kid.
Now, we also get to know more than a little bit about this small town police force. And not only in the case of what happened here with Billy Joe Johnson, but broader patterns and practices. And I'm using that language of patterns and practices purposefully, given that they ended up under consent decree, although did not, as part of that settlement, did not end up having to, you know, indicate that they'd actually had wrongdoings.
Yeah, so those are two different counties. That's the Madison County, and they're in George County. Let me kind of rewind a little bit. So what we did in this series is I've been thinking a lot about, like, not just Mississippi but the United States, and how we have all these lived experiences of what Black people go through. And the collective, you know, for lack of a better term, the collective trauma that we all go through. I think that, you know, one thing that I noticed, and this is kind of a little bit of a blanket statement, but one thing that I noticed that, like, with a lot of colleagues, both white and friends who are white, is that, like, they don't have the same collective trauma. They can see, like, for example, when George Floyd died, a lot of people were obviously upset about it. We saw all across the country people come out on the streets, and absolutely. But I think that, like, with Black folks, it's a different kind of trauma, because it brings back all the other times that this has happened. Not just the cases that everybody knows about, but the cases that, like, you know, family members know about that don't get the publicity. And so what I wanted to do is really try to help listeners understand, like, how that collective trauma is carried both in the community, in Billie Joe's family, and also, like, you know, in myself. So we took stories from all over Mississippi that connected to what was going on in George County around that time. So we have some reporting that, like, in George County, the type of things that were happening in Madison County, i.e. like the police setting up barricades and checking everybody's ID when they're going from one part of town to the other, the police harassing or pulling Black folks over for really no reason. Like, all of those things kind of connect together because it gives context to the time and the place where Billie Joe was living.
As you talk about that experience of experiencing one kind of racial moment while your white colleagues might be experiencing something different, that's also part of the podcast. You are very much present in it, as is your reporting partner. And you all have conversations about kind of how an interview went or what you're thinking about sort of how the investigation is going. And it is certainly a frank and revealing way to hear that kind of interracial conversation.
Yeah. I felt like it was really important to let the listener kind of in on, like, how race not only works in this case, but how it works in reporting this story. And I think, you know, like, people are having these conversations all the time. We just tend to not record them. And I have to give it up to my reporting partner, Jonathan Jones, that, like, you know, he took a deep breath and dove into the deep end with me, even though I know, like, it was definitely scary for him. I mean, on one side, especially the conversation that we have in episode 6, I think on one side, I think his big worry is that, like, he was going to be looked at as, like, the clueless white guy. You know, on the flip side, my biggest worry about putting that out is that I would be labeled as the angry Black man. And so both of us just kind of had to trust each other to go in and actually just put it out there. I mean, ultimately, like, I really don't care if someone thinks I'm the angry Black man, like, whatever. At this point in my career, if I don't get a job because people think I'm the angry Black man, I don't need that job. So, but I do think, you know, it took a lot of courage for JJ to be honest and open the way we were.
You know, as you're saying that, I'm thinking about your interviews with Mississippi white police officers who say there's no race problem here. That's something of the past. And on the one hand, you know, I hear that as patently ridiculous, right? That, you know, without even going somewhere, I can just look at the demographics and I can show you there are racial inequalities. On the other hand, as a Southerner, I gotta say it also resonated with me that, like, actually, interpersonally, I actually find the warmest interracial experiences in the South, that the most sort of regular, you know, presumption that Black people will be in public space, for me at least, happens in the South. And that actually all of my most sort of horrifying racial, interpersonal racial encounters happened not below the Mason-Dixon, but above it.
Right. I think you are 100% right. Explaining race in America, if alien beings came to the United States, it would be so hard to explain the twists and turns that race takes in the United States. You know, after we interviewed that former police officer and he said that there were no racial issues, the next thing you hear in the show after JJ and I's conversation is me talking to a Black alderman, Carrie Molds, there. And she basically says she doesn't see racism that often either. And I felt like it was important to have her experience to kind of, because I know what the listener is going to be thinking, because the same thing I'm thinking, like, that's patently ridiculous. But then the lived experience of a lot of Black folks is, it's complicated. It's really complicated. It's not like cut and dry. And, you know, I think that, you know, the thing for me about the South is the South has clarity in a way that a lot of places in the United States do not. Like, I know where I'm not wanted in the South. It's clear. I also know very clearly where I'm celebrated and not just tolerated. And in my home city, Jacksonville, Florida, I feel that so much. Like, I feel like I'm loved when I go home. That being said, there are places that I don't go because I know that those places do not love me. And then when we dig a little bit deeper and we look at like what the racial inequality actually looks like, it's like, you know, black neighborhoods in my city tend to be the neighborhoods that flood, right? Tend to be the places that don't get the same help that white neighborhoods do. It's a very, you know, tricky thing and hard needle to thread.
I don't want to give away anything in this podcast because I want folks to walk this investigative journey along with you, along this kind of sonic and emotional and sometimes traumatic journey. But what do you feel like you can tell us and tell the listeners of The Takeaway about how they should be thinking about approaching this? And as they begin to listen, what are some of the twists and turns that they might be able to expect?
Yeah, sure. When we first started working on this, I had a vision in my head, and it was really hard for me to describe to the team like what I was trying to do, what I wanted to do. And I think that was because I think a lot of these type of investigations, when they get turned into podcasts, they end up becoming very true crime in their viewpoint. And I have no problem at all with true crime. You know, people love what they love. I'm not going to, like, you know, ick on the thing that they love. I would just say that I did not want to do true crime with this. What I wanted to do is really dive into the complexities of the case, of the place, and of, you know, the United States and how race works in it all. And I think that what we've been trying to do is look at this from the angle of, this is what happens in an official investigation. This is what happens in the community who is completely disconnected from that investigation. And then the results, this is what it looks like. This is why nobody is happy with the end result, because the community is kept out of the investigation. The way that the investigation looked at the family or treated the family felt like, you know, oh my goodness, these people are just like making a lot of noise for no reason. And there's plenty of reason why the community and the family were making a lot of noise. And so what we're trying to do is to show what that gap is and to show who's on each side, and also to remind, you know, the listeners every step of the way that Billy Joe was a human being. He had family and people who cared and loved him. And he's not a character in a podcast you love, but he is a person. He had weight. His life mattered. And also on the flip side, like, you know, he was in an on and again, off again relationship with a young white girl. And I would say that, like, what we're really trying to do with that is also say she was a 17-year-old girl. She was not some diabolical planner, you know, trying to get back at Billy Joe. She was 17. Doesn't mean she was great and pure. Doesn't mean she was, you know, bad and evil either. She was a human being. And so I'm just trying to make sure that Billy Joe's family retains their dignity in the telling of this story, that Billy Joe's life matters, and that we also frame everybody in the light of, these are human beings, and sometimes maybe they didn't like reach up to the standard that we would like them to. But I do believe that, like, and this is like me coming from reading Brené Brown, I do believe that everybody is trying their best in some way, shape, form, or fashion.
Last question. As you were bringing up Billy Joe's family, have they heard it? And what do they think about it?
Yeah, it's complicated. Yes, they've heard it. And yes, they love it. They're not crazy about some of the things that some people said, obviously. But it's important to me that the family be with us every kind of step of the way. And I think when we first came down there, you know, 3 years ago, they weren't listening to podcasts. They didn't really even understand like what it was that we were trying to do, because it's not really their medium. So they were super generous and let us in, even though they didn't quite get it. I mean, I think if we had came down with cameras, they would have definitely understood it. But like, radio is, you know, something that they don't really, they listen to, you know, regular radio, like the hits, right? That being said, like now they listen to it, they really enjoy it, and they're in it. You know, we had our final meeting with them, I guess, about 3 weeks ago now, which will be coming out this week, and you can really hear how that went. It's complicated, like everything in this case.
Indeed, complicated and very, very much worth listening to. Al Letson is the host of the National Investigative News program, Reveal, and he's been working on this investigative podcast, Mississippi Goddamn, The Ballad of Billy Joel. Thank you.
Thank you.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.
This hour, we've been exploring race, power, and media storytelling as we discussed a documentary film and an investigative podcast dealing with issues of race, policing, and incarceration. But it's wrong to imagine that the stories of race in America are all centered in systems of inequity and violence. Latinx and Black folk are far more than the sum of the structural disadvantages affecting our lives. So we turn now to a story of grit, grind, triumph, and tennis.
I'm very confident.
You say it so easily. Why?
Because I believe it.
That's the radiant, confident 14-year-old Venus Williams in a television interview back in 1995. And when the reporter kept pushing the self-possessed teen to explain why she was confident, well, Daddy Richard Williams was not having it.
Cut right here, if you don't mind, and let me tell you what she has said. She said it with so much confidence the first time. But if you keep going on and on.
Listen, we can't keep interrupting. I mean, if you want...
You got to understand that you're dealing with an image of a 14-year-old child. And this child going to be out there playing when your old ass and me going to be in the grave. When she says something, we done told you what's happening. You're dealing with a little black kid and let her be a kid. She done answered it with a lot of confidence. Leave that alone.
Now, that exchange from an ABC broadcast captures so much about the Williams family patriarch. His abiding love for his daughters, and his keen understanding that as Black girls in a very white sport, he would have to do more than train them as fantastic athletes. He would have to ensure they had an unshakable grounding of self-love and community connection. In the new film, King Richard, which is currently in theaters and on HBO Max, Will Smith plays Richard Williams, revealing complex layers to a man who's often been depicted by the media as overbearing. Here he is in a scene when a neighbor calls child services on Richard and his wife.
Now, I understand you got to do your job, even if some crazy-ass neighbor do call talking foolishness. And I don't even mind you saying we hard on these kids. You know why? Because we are. That's our job, to keep them off these streets. You want to arrest us for that? Fine, but what you're not gonna never do is come knock on this door talking about you had to blow their damn brains out in them streets because they running with hoodlums and doing drugs and things. That's what you're not never gonna say in this house.
Now, Smith is getting some very well-deserved recognition for his performance in the film, but the movie wouldn't work without a clear vision behind it. And that's where director Rinaldo Marcus Green comes in. King Richard is just his third feature-length film, but Green was the right man for the job. In part because of his own experience playing sports as a kid.
So baseball was my primary sport, and it was the sport that my father, you know, wanted my brother and I, my brother Rashad Ernesto Green, who's also a filmmaker, ironically, we both turned out to be filmmakers and not baseball players. But my dad, you know, very much like Richard Williams, thought he was raising two major league baseball players. And so we spent the first third of our lives essentially on a baseball diamond. And we played everything, obviously middle, you know, little league and travel ball and intramurals, and then played high school baseball and continued to play at a college level. I had two major league tryouts. I didn't make it. And so I wound up choosing a different profession, or it wound up choosing me when I was no longer able to play. But I knew what it was like being a highly competitive athlete. And you know, working really hard for something and spending countless hours on a court with a dad that wore short shorts, very similar to Richard Williams. And so I had a very eccentric father, one that also taught us, hopefully, to be well-rounded human beings. And that included getting an education, and education was something that he put at the forefront, you know, together with sports. And so my brother went to Dartmouth, and he, you know, he certainly, you know, was trying to mold good citizens, I guess, if you will. And it was hard because we grew up in a single parent household. And although our mom remained in our lives, we were really at home with dad. And dad was quite unique in the way that Richard was. And so I had a very, you know, unique sort of upbringing. And I thought that that was something, a perspective that I could bring to the film.
I will say this film absolutely reversed my understanding of who Richard Williams is. And it's not that I ever spent much time thinking that much about it, but certainly I was obsessed with Venus as a young person growing up, have adored watching Serena become, you know, the greatest of all time. But I sort of thought of Richard as being precisely how he was represented by mass media, as someone slightly obsessed, kind of a, you know, kind of crazy tennis parent, and someone who was maybe mean and harsh, and in today's parlance, just did too much all the time. Then this film altered that for me in some really critical ways. For you, as you came to this story, how did your understanding of Richard Williams develop?
I didn't know much about Richard Williams at all, and I didn't grow up watching tennis. And, you know, everything I knew about tennis was because of Venus and Serena. You know, growing up as a young Black man, of course, you know about Tiger Woods, you know about Venus and Serena because they
played. Is there more to tennis than that? I don't know.
Yeah, exactly. It's sadly, we didn't know, you know, and you know, that, but we rooted for them regardless because we had to. It was like, of course you're going to root for these two girls from Compton who are the, you know, arguably the greatest athletes of all time. Like, we were just fans from afar. And then when I found out about the film, of course, you know, I went down the rabbit hole to find out everything I could about Richard Williams. I read his book, and look, he's a complicated man. It wasn't something that I thought we could sugarcoat, but we only have 2.5 hours to show that side. And there was a lot that was already portrayed about Richard Williams in the media. And so the side of Richard Williams that I, you know, that we as a you know, filmmaking collective, I felt like, you know, from the producers to the family, we got access to, you know, Serena, Venus, you know, Oracine, and we were able to sit down with them and prep and hear their version of who they thought their dad was. And the one thing that was consistent, because everybody's memory is very different, you know, especially at 8 and 9, you forget things, was how much love, you know, Richard and Oracine gave to those girls. And so it was incredibly rich to hear their love and admiration of their parents, what they gave to them, how much respect they have for them. And I think this is their love letter in a lot of ways to their father.
There's also a bit of a love letter to Compton. And again, in the same ways that we have a complicated Richard Williams, we also had a pretty complicated community that you've given us. Talk to me about the decisions you were making about how to portray the difficulties and the support that came out of that community, and the way that all of the Williams daughters are made from where they are from.
It was important to not make it a get out of Compton story. It's a I come from Compton story. You wear that with pride where you're from. I know being born in the Bronx was so important for my father, literally where we were, like, my mom went into labor in Jersey and he like drove us to the Bronx to make sure that both of his kids were going to be born in the Bronx. Like, that, I mean, that was the insanity of my father. But like, in his mind, his kids had to be from that place, and the pride that he had from being from the Bronx. And I think for them, Compton is that. Like, they are so prideful from where they are from. They still have roots there. It's not like, yes, I'm sure that they were in some ways happy to have moved on to another level, but that Compton is a part of who they are. It's a part of their journey. And it's part of why they have been as successful as they are in life. And I think where you're from is such a sense of pride, especially if you love that community and you love the people that you grew up in, those memories there. And for them, look, you would hear the stories about Richard getting beat up on the court. You would hear the stories of the girls playing tennis and, there would be a drive-by shooting. All of the girls would drop to the ground, wait for the bullets to stop, and then get up and continue practice. And you're like, wait, what? So like, it's insane to think about. But when you're from that neighborhood, it's normal. These are the things that happen in your community all the time. So you don't really look at it as a dangerous place, although you know that it is. There's a certain awareness, and there's a certain level of armor that you have from coming from a certain community, and having grown up in a similar, you know, sort of environment on the East Coast. I understood that like my home is part of who I am. It's not to look down upon or look bad at. It is part of who we are. And Venus and Serena were mentoring all along while they were still going up, even as young kids. We showed that in the film, even at Rick Macy's, that they were mentoring. They didn't wait to become famous to then give back to the community. They were doing it all along. And that's just a testament to who they are, where they're from. Compton is a true fabric of it's part of their journey. It's not an addendum to their story. And that's why we spend so much time on it in our film. You know, I think our film really benefits from a longer first act, from us getting to know the girls, where they live, the street where they grew up on, you know, but also paying homage to the community that helped them get to where they are. And so it's not just looking at this community as this place that you'd never wanted to go to or that we should never be. It's like, no, we exist. And there are plenty of Venus and Serenas out there. If we put a little pride in our community, we can nourish a lot more talent from these places. And I hope that our film is, you know, shows that it's possible.
Let's talk about Mama. It is certainly about Richard Williams at the center. And in certain ways, even the characters of Venus and Serena are secondary to us understanding King Richard. But right there at the heart of it is Oracine Price. Talk to me a bit about, as you all were, as you said, doing the long first act, getting to know folks, how was that partnership, which I thought was so fabulously and interestingly and richly represented in the film, how did various members of the family remember that partnership?
Well, I think they fought for it in a way that was beautiful. And, you know, the film is obviously called King Richard, but I've heard from a few people that maybe it should be Queen Brandy too, you know, and it so is. I think she's so critical to our story. She's so critical to the success of the girls, but also to their faith. You know, she was really there, not just as a mother in support, which we all are, right? But it's like she was there coaching full time, working full time, not only putting food on the table, but providing the food that went on the table. And I think that's an important thing for us to have learned about, you know, Oracine. When I met Oracine, I was with Zach Valen, the writer, Tim White, the producer. We flew down to South Florida to meet her. And this is before I had cast the role. And one of the first things she said to me was, "Don't make me a chump." You know, that's the one, you know. Well, she definitely was no chump. And I could tell from the moment I went in that room, like, she was a tough woman that had been through a lot. But what I respected most about her was although things didn't work out with Richard, you know, that she was very respectful in the memory of him. And she just wanted to make sure that she was being represented in a way that felt authentic and not sort of pushed to the side. You know, if you just Google her, you'll see her in the stands, but you don't really understand how integral of a part she was in not only the development of the girls, but Open Stance really came from her. You know, that was something that she, because when she was pregnant, she couldn't get her hips around. And so she wound up staying open. And although Richard exploited that and was like, wait, we can use that to the girls' game, you know, he learned it from Oracine. So we learned these little things in the conversation with the family. And it was just things that little pearls that we can put into the film. And so Oracine has such a presence. She has such a poise about her. And that those were probably the words that I would communicate with Anjanou the most. And first of all, I have to say a word about Anjanou Ellis, who is absolutely at the height of her game. She is an incredible actress. She brought such depth and dimension to the role, which I don't know if, you know, everyone can do what she did. And she really, really gave a gravitas to each and every scene that she was in. She stole moments in a way that is just, she was such a formidable force to go toe-to-toe with Will in those scenes. So it's a testament to her performance, but hopefully we provided that space where she could find moments and she could really deliver within sort of, you know, the real estate that she had. You know, the movie is called King Richard, and for her to have such a presence in the film, it really was a testament to her fighting for each and every word, each and every line, us making sure that we were as respectful to her role as the matriarch of the family as humanly possible. And I just couldn't say enough great things about her. I hope she gets everything and more for this and beyond.
It is absolutely lovely to speak with you. And thank you so much for this film, which, again, was such a big part of my Thanksgiving holiday with my family. So many conversations were had about parenting, about marriage, and definitely about that open stance. Rinaldo Marcus Green is the director of King Richard. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
That's the show, y'all. But before we go, we wanted to remind you of another recent race and media moment that made us smile here at The Takeaway. If you tuned into the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade last Thursday, maybe you noticed a new balloon filling the sky above New York City's Herald Square. Ada Twist Scientist debuted in this year's parade. Filled with black girl magic, the brown-skinned, Afro-puffed, lab-coated junior scientist began as a 2016 children's book and became a Netflix series earlier this year. More than anything else, what makes little Ada a scientist is her relentless pursuit of information. Never satisfied with a response to the question, what? Ada wants to know why, and she insists on figuring out how. Maybe she's a journalist too. As Ada Twist made her way down the parade route last week, you only needed to glance at the little upturned faces in the crowd or read the outpouring of joy on social media to know representation matters. The stories we tell with our cameras, our mics, our books, and yes, our balloons help to shape the nation we are and the nation we will become. So if you've missed any of the stories that we tell here on The Takeaway, or you just want to share them with others, remember to subscribe to our podcast. It's available wherever you get all your other podcasts. Come on back tomorrow for our politics show. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway.